We're talking about medical malpractice in Wisconsin here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Injured Patients and Families Compensation Fund guarantees payment of all economic damages. That means medical costs. But when it comes to pain and suffering, the limit for non-economic damages is $750,000. And this compensation fund recently paid out its second largest settlement award to a Fitchburg family. Are you a doctor or another healthcare worker? What do you think of Wisconsin's medical malpractice laws? Do they provide enough protection for you and your patients? What questions do you have about medical malpractice cases here in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234, so you can join in. David Wahlberg is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, let's start with this most recent lawsuit that resulted in the second largest award from the state's malpractice insurance fund. Can you tell us what the family claimed went wrong with their care?
Yeah, so this is a family from Fitchburg near Madison, and they had a newborn, 6-week-old boy who had surgery for a birth defect a few years ago at the Children's Hospital at UW Health. And the surgery went fine, but in terms of fixing the birth defect, but he had some problems during anesthesia, apparently from low blood pressure, and suffered a permanent brain injury from that.
What did the family say happened to their child as a result of this surgery? Where is this child today?
Yeah, I wasn't able to speak to the family directly, but their attorney said the boy, who is now 3, is blind and can't walk or speak and will likely function permanently at the level of a young child.
What do we know about the physicians who handled this surgery, and what about them?
Yeah, so there were sort of at least two doctors involved in this case. One was a resident or a doctor in training who is near the very end of his training in anesthesia. And then, as all residents have, there's a supervising doctor, or what they call an attending. And so the claim, that the lawsuit was claiming that the resident was responsible for this injury. But the state, and actually the resident himself, argued that it should have been the supervising doctor that was held responsible.
So this physician failed to react to this prolonged low blood pressure readings during the surgery. Is that it?
Right. Yes. And that sustained low blood pressure is believed to have caused a permanent brain injury from a lack of oxygen.
So a lawsuit was brought. Do we know if Wisconsin's medical board took any action against these physicians?
As of now, I believe no. And the way the medical board is set up, they generally react or respond to complaints made against doctors. That can be done by a patient who maybe has a complaint against a doctor or a coworker. But often the complaints come in as lawsuit determinations, whether that's a jury award or a settlement. So the fact that the settlement was just made last month, that in and of itself would act as a complaint against at least the one doctor, the resident in this case. And so it's likely that that the state would be looking at whether that's something to discipline or not.
So how did the doctors and the state's malpractice insurance fund respond to the family's claims?
Yeah, so one argument the state fund made was that they believe that the supervising doctor should be held responsible. And if that were to be proven, that would bring into play another cap that we have in the state. So for state employees, and that includes UW doctors, they have a cap of $250,000 for all kinds of damages. That's economic and non-economic. So that's quite a bit less than the $750,000 cap for just non-economic.
And that's quite a bit of difference there. Just a quarter million for all damages. Do we know did the doctors acknowledge the mistakes were made in the procedure? How did the hospital respond?
I've read part of the court file, but not the entire thing. So I don't know all the details of how both parties responded. But at least with my recent story about the settlement payments, UW said, they had a statement saying that they thought the payment was fair to all parties involved, and they expressed their deepest compassion to the family for what happened.
We're talking about medical malpractice cases here in Wisconsin with David Wahlberg. He is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you a physician or another healthcare worker? What do you think of Wisconsin's medical malpractice laws? Do they provide enough protection for you and your patients? What questions do you have about medical malpractice cases here in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. So, David, the State Insurance Fund agreed to settle this case, pay the family $22.5 million. How did they come to that amount? How did they come to that settlement?
Yeah, so as we discussed, there is a cap of $750 for non-economic damages, which is essentially pain and suffering, but there is no cap for economic damages. So the vast majority of that $22.5 million is economic damages, and it's chiefly for future health care for that child. It's a very young child, and he's still expected to live well into his 50s or beyond. So that's quite a bit of care right there. And then the other factor that's usually brought in is lost wages. So, earnings that that child would have made as an adult that he likely won't now. And so most of that $22.5 million is put into two funds to pay for care for the child. In this case, the family, the parents, got just a little bit less than $2 million of that. And then there was about $4.5 million for legal fees, attorney's fees.
There was this national study a decade ago looking at malpractice jury trials, found that doctors almost always win when there is weak evidence of negligence. Doctors win half the time, even when there is strong evidence against them. Does this sound correct to you as you look at malpractice cases?
Yes, and I think that's true, and perhaps even more so true in Wisconsin. The last time I kind of looked closely at this a few years ago, I think doctors won about two-thirds of the cases versus one-third for the plaintiffs, cases that went to a jury trial. I think generally people have a lot of trust in doctors and believe they're, trying to do the right thing. So they tend to, that trust comes out in the way juries decide cases a lot of times.
We're talking about medical malpractice here in Wisconsin with David Wahlberg as our guide. He's a Wisconsin State Journal health and medicine reporter. You can join in with your questions, your perspectives on medical malpractice, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Wisconsin's oversight of physicians and other health professionals? Do you think the state is doing enough to prevent or stop poor medical care? Have you filed a complaint against a doctor? What was that experience like? What was the process? Call in. You can also tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at medical malpractice cases here in Wisconsin, how the compensation fund works. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The compensation fund provides unlimited coverage for economic damages, but limits payouts for non-economic damages to $750,000. Some researchers say medical errors should be the third leading cause of death in our country after cancer and heart disease. They estimate it accounts for about 250,000 deaths a year due to medical mistakes. Have you filed a complaint against a physician? What was your experience with the process? Did you choose to file a malpractice lawsuit? Why or why not? We're at 800-642-1234. David Wahlberg is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He stays with us. Let's bring in Chris now, joining us from Hillboro. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
In 2001, my dad was put into the hospital because of he was having chest pains. So they wanted to monitor him overnight. And that night, the nurses had called the doctor to let them know that he was in a lot of pain, and the doctor never came in. He actually told them to tell him to relax, give him soothing music, and they medicated him a little bit. The next morning, we got a phone call saying they were Metaflighting him to La Crosse, and he died 11 minutes up. And the cause was he had so many heart attacks throughout the night that his heart just couldn't handle it anymore. And when we talked to the doctor, he said he was sorry he didn't come in. We did have an investigation done. They said they were appalled by the practices. But since I was an adult child, because I was over 18, and my parents had separated, that we could not sue. And to this day, I have no trust in our medical system. And being a special ed teacher, I love kids, and I know doctors play an important part in their health, but when you go through something like that, you just, it's hard to forgive.
Chris, thank you for bringing your story. David, what do you hear there?
Well, that brings up two points to me. One is a lawsuit is one way to seek a remedy to an unfortunate situation like that, and I'm sorry to hear about that. Another one is to file a complaint with the state and see if the medical board might take an action against that doctor. The other point that brings up, Chris, I believe your name was, you're correct that Wisconsin is one of the few states that doesn't allow adult children to sue on behalf of their parents for malpractice. Likewise, adults can't sue on behalf of their parents can't sue on behalf of their adult children. And just to back up a minute, that's one of basically three factors in Wisconsin that doctors would say make it a good place to practice for them. Malpractice attorneys and patients like Chris might say it makes it a difficult place to get, to get made whole after an injury. So the other point, the other factors are the fund, which we've been talking about, because that limits liability for doctors, and then also these caps, and there's a few different kinds of caps in the state.
So, David, why do we see these caps, and do other states have similar limits?
Yeah, I don't know what the latest numbers are exactly, but many other states have caps, but not all. There are some states that don't have any caps, and the amounts of the caps range. And so in Wisconsin, we have, I don't want to get too complicated here, but we have three different kinds of caps. We've already talked about two of them, $750,000 for non-economic damages for most doctors, $250,000 for all damages for UW doctors. And then there's another kind of cap for wrongful death cases, which are sometimes filed instead of malpractice. That's $500,000 for adults or children and $350,000 for parents. So other states, or adults, I should say, many other states have some kind of cap, but few states have all three factors that I was talking about earlier, the fund, the caps, and some restrictions on who can sue.
And last year, our state Supreme Court rejected a constitutional challenge to limit malpractice awards. What was the court's argument there for upholding these limits?
Yeah, so that involved a case of a woman in Milwaukee County back in 2011. She had abdominal pain. The story is a little bit similar to the one we just heard from your listener. She went to the hospital and they ended up sending her away. She went back another day or two later to a different hospital, and they eventually found that she had sepsis, or a body-wide systemic blood infection from, I think it was strep. And she ended up going into a coma. She ended up having gangrene on her legs and arms, and they had to amputate all four limbs. So quite a severe injury. She was about 50 years old. The jury in that case, there was a lawsuit filed, and the jury awarded about $25 million total. About $9 million of that was economic damages, which isn't limited. And then the other $16 million or so was for the non-economic damages, pain and suffering, and also loss of companionship for her husband. That should be, according to law, that's supposed to be reduced to $750,000 because of the cap. But the judge in that case said, no, this case shows that the cap is unconstitutional. This woman suffered so much damage that you can't just give her a tiny fraction of what the jury felt she needed. So that went to an appeals court. The appeals court agreed with the judge that the cap should be thrown out. And then last year, as you mentioned, I think in July, the state Supreme Court ruled, and they ended up upholding the cap. So that brings her non-economic damages down then from roughly $16 million to $750,000.
Let's bring in Gary now, joining us from Ripon. Gary, hi.
Hello. Well, my comment is I was once married to a medical doctor, and I can tell you that at least the doctors we associated with, they just loathe. I mean, they literally loathe lawyers in the whole malpractice industry. There were even one or two of them that just simply quit medicine because they said I worked my butt off to try to do the right thing by the patient, and then in the end I got sued. So that's the other side of the coin, and you're never going to be able to make a system where absolutely every case has a 100% desirable outcome. I mean, the person that called in about her father was a tragic case, but she doesn't know that the same thing wouldn't have happened if the doctor had come in.
Gary, thanks for the call. You know, physicians do, though, carry quite a bit of malpractice insurance. They have to, right, David?
Yes, they do. It varies from state to state. So in Wisconsin, because of this fund that we've been talking about, doctors don't have to carry as much malpractice insurance as some doctors in other states. So in Wisconsin, they have to carry private insurance to cover up to $1 million of a payout. But then anything over $1 million is covered by this state fund. So doctors say that makes Wisconsin a good place to practice because liability insurance premiums are generally a lot less here than in other states. And you're right that a lot of doctors don't like lawyers, malpractice attorneys, but, you know, I guess that's what the courts are for and juries are for, to determine, you know, which side should prevail.
Let's go to Maddie in De Pere now. Maddie, hi.
Hi. How do you find a lawyer who will take a case? I actually spoke on the Larry Miller show a few weeks ago about suing a doctor, and they said that they only win about 20% of the time, and so most lawyers don't want to take that kind of a case.
Maddie, thanks. We're short on time, Maddie. I want to get David to respond here to that. Is it difficult to find a malpractice attorney to take your case?
A lot of people say it is, and malpractice attorneys would say they have become more selective in accepting cases in recent years because of these caps and the fund and sort of the general attitude of the public that they tend to rule in favor of the doctor. So attorneys are more likely to take cases where they see a potential large payout than a case that might just have a small payout. And those tend to be cases involving young children who are injured but survive because they're going to have really high medical costs and loss of earnings in the future, like the one I recently wrote about in Madison.
So as we wrap up here in the last few seconds, how common are malpractice cases here in Wisconsin? Are they becoming less common since the Supreme Court's ruling?
I don't know that. Certainly, jury awards against doctors and payments against doctors are fairly rare in Wisconsin. But in terms of how many suits are filed to begin with, I'm not exactly sure what the trend is. But I hear that it's going down.
David, thank you for joining us.
Sure. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
David Wahlberg is a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. We've been looking at medical malpractice suits here in Wisconsin and the compensation fund. Coming up, we'll talk with a political scientist about the latest twists and turns after the Mueller investigation. We'll get up to speed after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. President Trump claimed executive privilege over the full Mueller report. We're slowing down, taking developments one at a time here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The House Judiciary Committee voted yesterday afternoon to recommend that the House hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for failing to turn over the unredacted report, which was released with some parts withheld last month. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Should a full unredacted version of the Mueller report be made available to Congress? Is the president within his rights to invoke executive privilege to keep this information private? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Susan Johnson is a political science professor at UW-Whitewater, where she directs the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. Susan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with executive privilege. Define it for us, and because this doesn't come up all the time in politics, help us understand what it is.
So executive privilege is not found in the Constitution, but we've had presidents invoke this idea of executive privilege. I think the term goes back to the Eisenhower administration, but you can look back as far as Washington and Jefferson to see examples where a president has invoked this idea that there are certain things that are just meant to be held within the executive. And these tend to be things related to national security issues, or another big topic that comes up when we discuss executive privilege is the idea of a president being able to have internal White House deliberations not become more public. So, I mean, that's the context. And what we've seen more recently is presidents in the post-Cold War era, let's say, or even from Reagan on, who have used it much more so than we have seen it in the past.
So this time being used, President Trump exerting executive privilege to shield portions of the Mueller report, the unredacted report, as well as other information relating to the Russia investigation. How will this work going forward? Can the president effectively shield this information indefinitely?
Well, one of the interesting things about President Trump's claim of executive privilege is that it's a very broad claim. If you look back over the past few presidents who have used executive privilege, it's been narrower. I would argue you'd have to kind of go back to Nixon and one of his claims of executive privilege that was very broad. And in that regard, what President Trump is doing, we're thinking about this in the context of the Mueller report, but I think that many are thinking that it's much broader and it would be anything to do with the Russia investigation or even broader. So I think that some are looking at this as a first step in what may be a series of executive privilege claims. And he did an interview just last week where he had mentioned that he was probably not going to allow anybody involved in that process of the investigation to testify before Congress. So I think he was giving a little preview of what he was planning on doing in that regard.
So at this point, what might Democrats be looking for in the unredacted Mueller report? Is there something there that needs to be protected and shielded, even for lawmakers?
Well, there's the whole issue of the grand jury testimony information that, as I understand it, cannot be handed over to Congress. And so that's part of the issue. And remember, I mean, there's a lot of politics in play here as well. And there had been negotiations ongoing about how much more of the report that Congress was going to be able to see. And those negotiations broke down after a short period of time. And that's what pushed this to the point that we got to yesterday, where a whole lot was going on. I mean, normally when Congress asks for different documents, there's a negotiation that takes place about what is going to be included in those documents. And oftentimes the president will claim that there's national security issues or other reasons. In this case, the issue has to do with some of the work of the grand jury. And it just got to the point where I think both sides were digging in their heels to a certain degree. And the negotiations were getting nowhere. And so at that point, the president issued this idea of executive privilege.
We're looking at developments on Capitol Hill as the president, as we said, asserts executive privilege over the Mueller report. What that means, Susan Johnson is a professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. You can join in 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on this? Should a full unredacted version of the Mueller report be made available to Congress? Is the president well within his rights, within his means to invoke executive privilege, even if it's sweeping, to keep this information private? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Susan, Democrats have really come out swinging against the president. And here's Democratic Representative and Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, who has referred to the situation that we're in a constitutional crisis here.
The law must be vindicated. The American people must know what's going on. Appropriate action, whatever that may be, must be taken. And the president must not be permitted to operate a lawless administration and become a king.
So what is he making here? What reference is he making by saying we're in a constitutional crisis?
Well, I think that what I've seen, there's no standard definition of constitutional crisis, but what I've seen people use sort of colloquially is this idea that when you have the Congress and the executive branch unable to really function together. And we're seeing that, I mean, this is the thing we're talking about this morning with this executive privilege claim as well in regard to the Mueller report, but there's just so much more. And so I think that what Congressman Nadler is saying is that what we're seeing the White House do is across the board put up roadblocks to Congress's ability to provide its oversight function. And I think we've heard many members of Congress over the course of the Trump administration argue that they're not seen as being a co-equal branch of government. And so they're, again, Congress is trying to, the House is trying to reassert that.
Well, we can see those loggerheads with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who had this to say earlier this week on the Senate floor.
2 years of exhaustive investigation and nothing to establish the fanciful conspiracy theory that Democratic politicians and TV talking heads had treated like a foregone conclusion.
So one of the big criticisms here from Republicans now is that Democrats are really playing political theater at this point. Is that a message that is being taken by the public, by lawmakers? Is this political theater?
You know, it's interesting that when you talk to, when you look at public opinion data, the fact is that a lot of the public is not paying attention to a lot of what's going on in Washington in this regard. If you listen to some of the Democrats who are running for president and they're asked, what do voters want to talk about? Almost all of them will respond back that voters are not asking questions about what's going on here. So I don't know how much of this is resonating with your average voter. President Trump's approval ratings have remained fairly steady, up and down a few points here and there with the release of the report, with other things. And so I just don't know if this is if McConnell is right to a certain degree in the sense that this is very much of Washington. And I don't know how many people in Wisconsin every day are getting up and thinking about this.
Democratic House leaders could also file a lawsuit against the Justice Department to get the Mueller report. Do you have a sense as to whether that would actually be a viable option for them?
It's absolutely a viable option, but the issue is the timing. And so certainly there have been, after executive privilege claims, lawsuits that have been filed, and Congress has been successful in instances in those lawsuits, or there's been a negotiated settlement of those lawsuits. But in almost every instance, it's been after the president in question is out of office.
We saw last night that House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff issued a subpoena to the Justice Department, and he said in a statement that he would go to court if necessary to enforce his subpoena. And Schiff gave Attorney General William Barr a deadline of Wednesday to hand over the evidence. What do we know about this pressure coming from the Intelligence Committee?
It's, again, it's part of this multi-pronged approach from the Democrats to use their investigatory oversight power of the White House or of the executive branch.
We also heard from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and she was previously cautioned the party against impeachment, but she had this to say about it this week at an event at Cornell.
Trump is goading us to impeach him. That's what he's doing. Every single day, he's just like taunting, because he knows that it would be very divisive in the country, but he doesn't really care. Just wants to solidify his base.
So even with what House Speaker Pelosi had to say here, do you see the impeachment option, the road path there, becoming more perhaps tempting for Democrats?
Yeah, I do. I feel like someone like Speaker Pelosi, if you go back to the beginning of her reassuming the role of Speaker just earlier this year, she was someone who was very much putting the brakes on any of those discussions about impeachment. And what we're seeing now is that she's speaking more openly about it. Democratic presidential candidates are speaking more openly about it. Elizabeth Warren came out quite strongly this week in support of it. So there's more of a drumbeat building, as I said, but to get the articles of impeachment drafted and moving that forward, that takes time. So there's some concern that this isn't something that would happen very quickly, where there'd be any quick resolution anyway. So, but to answer your question, yes, I'm seeing and hearing more about it.
UW-Whitewater political scientist Susan Johnson is our guide. You can join in. Do you side with Democrats who say President Trump is hiding something, or with Republicans who say all of this is just political theater? And where do we go from here? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're breaking down the developments on Capitol Hill, where last night House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff issued a subpoena to the Justice Department for all counterintelligence, all foreign intelligence information related to the Mueller probe, as well as the full unredacted report itself. So do you side with Democrats who say President Trump is hiding something, or with Republicans who say this is all political theater? And where do we go from here as a country? We're at 800-642-1234. Susan Johnson is a UW-Whitewater political science professor, and she stays with us for analysis. Let's go to Kevin, who is joining us from Janesville. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you. Number one, it's all politics. Number two, I do believe Congress does have the responsibility to oversee the executive branch. So I think they are well within their constitutional responsibility to ask for and investigate all of these documents in this report. Unfortunately, Mr. Trump probably does have the right to try to exert executive privilege But I also find it interesting that Attorney General Barr had no problem testifying before the Republican Senate, but is now digging in his heels about testifying in front of the Democratic-controlled House. As a typical average voter, I hope, I'm typical and average, trying to hide this does suggest at least that there is something to be hidden, and I want to know what's going on. Thank you.
Kevin, thank you for calling in. Susan, you know, what is being hidden here? What is President Trump trying to hide? And what about the Attorney General William Barr here in his testimony?
Yeah, I think Kevin brings up a really important point and a question. And thinking about Attorney General Barr and the fact that he did indeed testify about the report in front of the Senate last week, and was scheduled to also testify in front of the House, and then he said he wasn't going to attend, and he did not testify. And that's what got, I mean, a lot of this going. We've been talking about executive privilege, but a lot of that is also rolled up in the fact that Attorney General Barr refused to testify before the House, and therefore that led to some of the contempt stuff that I think we're going to be talking about as well.
Yes. And so members of the House Judiciary Committee spent their day yesterday debating whether to hold Attorney General Bill Barr in contempt of Congress for refusing to provide that full unredacted Mueller report. So what got us to this point of subpoena?
Well, Attorney General Barr was scheduled to testify, as we said, and then he decided not to. And that along with his unwillingness to provide the unredacted report to the House, then it created this stalemate. And the House has to use what tools it is given in order to try to compel testimony. And so what we're seeing with the Trump administration in particular is this, I would say, an unwillingness to make members of his administration available to speak to Congress. And this is, it's not just the case we're thinking about with Barr, but there's other examples as well. And I think we're going to see more moving forward. And Congress has, as its oversight responsibility, the ability to issue a subpoena to someone to come forward and testify. And what that contempt subpoena would do, it just kind of gets things rolling. And so what we're going to see next, what we'll see next is a vote on the full House, whether or not to hold Attorney General Barr in contempt of Congress. If in fact that vote is successful, then we are going to see the legal challenges come up with the lawsuits being filed in order to try to compel the testimony and also get the report.
Let's bring in Kelly now in Cascade with thoughts on this. Kelly, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling in as your average voter. I am totally interested in this. I feel like we, the American people, just kind of, at least a chunk of us, start saying, well, nothing's going to happen anyways. But, you know, underneath it, I want full transparency. And I feel like we deserve that. And in every other realm of society, we insist on transparency. And it's definitely needed on this case because it's too much getting covered over.
Kelly, thanks for the call. She is looking for transparency here, Susan Johnson, and looks to side with Congress wanting this unredacted report.
And I mean, I'm heartened to hear people calling in who are saying that they're paying attention, because like I said, most reporting suggests that people aren't. So, but I think that's the argument that the House Democrats are making, is that they need to see the full report. It is within their right to see the full report, and that's why they're making the claims that they are and being as aggressive as they are in their attempts.
So with Attorney General and contempt of Congress, is there precedent for this in the past? Have we seen this before?
We have. It's not common, but there is precedent. When the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, when President Obama was president, Attorney General Eric Holder was held in contempt of court, a contempt of Congress, I'm sorry, because of an investigation that was called the Fast and the Furious. And quite interestingly, while all of this is going on, that is still in negotiations about sort of settling all of that. So when I say that these things take time, we have a situation where the last time this happened, which is going back many years, that still hasn't fully been resolved, but there's that precedent. And then during the George W. Bush administration, it wasn't the Attorney General, but a few officials within the White House were held in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify before Congress.
And meanwhile, Robert Mueller himself is tentatively scheduled to testify before the Judiciary Committee in the House on May 15th. That would be next week. But President Trump has said he should not have to testify. How much is riding on this possible testimony from the special counsel himself?
Yeah, I haven't heard much recently about, I mean, since this weekend, about Mueller testifying and that date of May 15th. So I'll be really curious to see. This has sort of absorbed a lot of our attention right now. I would honestly be quite surprised, given that the president said last week that he was going to be directing most people to, or maybe all people, to not testify. So I think that it would be quite the coup if the House Democrats were able to get him to testify, but I'm not looking that that's going to happen soon.
Susan, there are so many twists and turns here every day on these developments. What should we be really paying attention to here in the coming days? What can we be filtering out?
I think that people need to focus on the fact that there are processes that have to play out. And so sometimes it seems overwhelming because there's so much going on. As you said, and yesterday was just one of those days where it was changing almost by the minute. I think just, you know, don't listen to the bluster and just pay attention to the processes that are playing out and looking for the actual information that's coming out as these investigations move forward. And I think that's kind of what I would advise.
As a political scientist, seeing so much division and animosity on Capitol Hill between branches of government, does that have an impact on our country and on how we govern?
Well, I think that we're at a point where we're having an inability to govern at the federal level. I mean, to be perfectly frank with you, and I don't know that it's just of the past few years, but it's certainly gotten much more difficult and much worse in the last few years.
Susan, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Susan Johnson is a professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. She's also director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. We've been talking about the fallout over the Russia probe, subpoenas for access to the full report. And just ahead, we look at the unique history of college dorms in America and how they've changed over time. What stood out to you about your college dorm? What did you like about dorm life? What did you hate about it? We're at 800-642-1234. Hope you join in. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.